Welcome to the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. If your job involves working with or influencing people's behavior, this podcast offers invaluable insights into what makes people tick. Through personal interviews that are thoughtful and surprising, we explore the full range of the roots to people smarts that can help you make or break your own career. My name is Marie Gervais, and with a PhD in culture and learning in the workplace and my own cultural journey, I bring the mysteries of human beings at work around the world to you. Through conversations with very diverse people, examining the groups they were born into and the ones they chose to belong to, my podcast takes a deep dive into why people do what they do and how they belong. Hone your skills to manage others and to be a better human being at work with the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. And now for today's episode. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Today, I have a wonderful treat for you. It is an interview with Rick Ivanovich, who is an accountant, techie, author, speaker, and CEO and CFO coach with a remarkable track record of guiding companies and individuals to success. As a serial entrepreneur, Rick has scaled businesses across various industries, creating multi-million dollar companies that serve clients in 80 countries, including top hotel chains and Fortune 500 companies. With over 40 years of experience in diverse sectors such as accounting, IT, talent, and oil and gas, Rick is a seasoned veteran in the business world. His 34-year presence in Vietnam is evident through his involvement in numerous organizations and his status as one of the longest-serving expats in the country. Congratulations for that designation. Rick is a visionary leader who combines business acumen with coaching and mentoring skills to help others achieve extraordinary success. I feel so honored to have you on the podcast, Rick.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast, Marie, and for such a lovely, lovely, lovely introduction. Before we start, and before you pepper me with some questions, I'd like to share a core belief I hold dear. We all have the potential to be architects of change. In today's era, which is really defined by constant transformation, our task is not just to keep up, but to actively shape the path forward. Looking at myself, I started stacking shelves and learning the ropes of people management as a trainee in a UK supermarket. Then I switched to the more precise world of accounting and later navigated the constantly evolving landscape of technology and humans. My story demonstrates the power of transformation and continuous learning and the significant impact each and every one of us can make. Whether they're big or small, our actions, they shape our future. And as we discuss stuff today, Marie, I want everybody listening to remember this. You are your brand. And every decision you make is part of the unique story you're crafting for yourself. How you react, how you adapt, and how you innovate in the face of change will define your story and your legacy. And this belief that inspiring each one of us to aim for balanced fulfillment is the cornerstone of my work, it's my life purpose. So as we dive into our conversation today, Marie, let's not just think about adapting to change, but about how we can define it. After all, when we embrace our unique qualities and strive for personal growth, we're not just participants, but catalysts in our ever-changing business as unusual world. So let's get started, Marie.
Great. Thank you for that. What I would like is for you to tell the audience a little bit about you personally, because we know about your business and we're going to get into that quite a bit more. But where did you grow up? Did you have a family? Give us a few little insights into you as a person.
Wow. Okay. I was brought up in the UK, just south of London, and I lived there until 94. And then I moved to China and started work in China. And then I was shifted to Vietnam, where I've been for 34 years. Although during that, I also got married to the daughter of a friend of mine. Moved to Singapore, had our first child, a daughter, then moved to Switzerland, had our second child, a son, moved back to Vietnam because that's where the business is, and just recently this year, moved back to Switzerland after having, you know, been in Vietnam on and off for 34 years. Mm. So I've bounced around a bit.
You have,
yes,
you have.
I do have a family.
Yeah, yeah, and you must be pretty resilient to do all of that bouncing. So let me ask you a little bit about your childhood, because I always like to start with that, since it pretty much shapes what we do. So incidents from your childhood, an actual incident, not a generalization. People sometimes start with, oh, and my childhood was, you know, I had a very supportive or I had a very difficult childhood, and then they just want to stop there. But I'm really interested in a specific incident that you feel has stayed with you as an adult and shaped who you are as a leader. It can be something really neutral, like I remember lying in the snow when I was a baby with the snowflakes falling on my face. I don't have any emotion associated with it, just noticing it. Or it can be something that was difficult or something that was a good lesson learned, or it can be an obstacle you overcame. But what stands out from your childhood that you think has stuck with you?
Two things. I'll start with later childhood when I was in my teens, and I'll go back to even earlier. In later childhood, at the end of school in the UK, end of sixth form, I did not do well in those final exams. I didn't get anywhere near what I should have done. And that resulted in, oops, I didn't make the grade. I couldn't get into university. I didn't have the grades. That's why I ended up working in a supermarket. What that ended up doing is, you know, I'd moved from being a sort of a straight A student to stacking shelves in a supermarket. It wasn't quite what I thought I was going to do, but it's put a tremendous chip on my shoulder, which I still have today. And I started trying to prove myself, acquiring qualifications to prove that I was really worthy. The other thing that sort of linked to that goes throughout school, especially in the early years. As you introduced me, my name is Rick Ivanovich. You know, Ivanovich begins with a Y. And funny enough, in school, whenever anything is done, it's always alphabetical, isn't it? And therefore, I was always last. I didn't like that. I'm also the youngest of nine siblings, and I don't like being last because I was last. So I've got a chip on my shoulder, and I don't like being last. That's triggered me to do things like overachieve.
But it's also, because you reflected on it, a point of strength at this point. If you just overachieved without any reflection, you'd be controlled by it.
Good point. You mentioned that I'm a coach. Of course, like all good coaches, I have my own coach. And actually, my core coach pointed out to me about a year ago that I was a hyperachiever. And I thought, what are you talking about? What have I achieved?
Yeah, that's common.
I don't achieve anything.
Yeah.
And his test was, oh, just tell the family, you know, next time you're having dinner or something. So I told them, they all fell on the floor laughing. And ever since then, I go, maybe I have achieved some stuff.
Because we tend to default to the negative and to the moving target of some unachievable goal, but we don't collect the milestones and look back on them and say, you know, this is a trajectory and I did not too badly, right?
Absolutely. See, you don't stop to smell the roses. You don't live in the moment. And an achievement is just, it's a nothing. For a while, myself, as maybe others who are high achievers or hyperachievers, they may be achieving a lot, but too many of us feel very, very empty because the achievement doesn't mean anything.
Because the achievement is just what you do. It's not who you are, although it points somewhat to who you are, but it does make it empty when people only focus on what they do or being recognized by others rather than themselves. And of course, you've changed. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to do all the things that you can do now. Let me ask you, as you got a little bit older, so late teens or early adulthood later on, is there something that stands out as being formative?
Lots of formative things as I got older. I married young. I was told I was too young to get married, but I did it anyway. And a year later, we broke up. So people didn't say, I told you so, but I would have said, I told you so. That was quite difficult.
What did that show you? If you're reflecting back on it now, what did that show you about you as a leader and your tendencies?
On that one, it actually put a lot more fuel onto the fire. Don't know if it was positive or negative, but, you know, it is as it is. It made me, for a while, I was very angry and bitter. And there was something that was taught to me by my stepfather when I was very, very young. He said that in your life, you will have many possessions. You might have cars, you know, watches, houses or whatever. You may have one or more wives. You may have many kids. But you know, you may lose them, they may leave you, they may break, you may change them. But there's only one thing that you keep for your entire life, and that's your career. Okay. I hadn't really taken that so seriously because the school that I went to, you know, we had it beaten into us that we have to perform all the time, like get the grades, get the grades, get the grades. And then I failed anyway. And this event really sort of triggered, okay, maybe, you know, I need to focus my mind on something, and that had to be my career. It's what I was doing anyway during the marriage. And, you know, that led to a lot of friction because I was studying to be an accountant, which means I used to put in at least 20 hours of study after work every week, maybe 30, and which means I'm thoroughly focused on that and not focused on the partnership. So I just doubled down on that and really went flat out to get myself going in my career. And everything was focused on the career. I guess I became even more insular, as it were, even more introverted. You know, being a numbers person, I'm introverted anyway. And I think that made me even more introverted. That stuck with me for a while.
If I were your stepfather, I would have just changed the last word. Instead of saying the only thing that doesn't change is your career, I would have said the only thing that doesn't change is your relationship with yourself.
Absolutely.
All of those other things can change, but you're kind of stuck with yourself. I'm stuck with myself too, you know? But at the same time, I've been my best friend. You've been your best friend.
Yeah, we're stuck with ourselves, except as I later learned is you can change yourself.
You can and improve your relationship with yourself so you're more respectful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, so during childhood and during school, you're always taught to perform. Earlier this year, I did a TEDx talk, and so I'll be repeating a few snippets from that. I'm sure everyone has felt you've got to work harder, or you've been told you've got to work harder. And it really didn't matter how I performed. If I got a C, people would say, hey, you've got to work harder to get an A. So when I got a B, I was still told you've got to work harder to get an A. And even if I got an A, you were told you've got to work harder to keep on getting A's. So it really didn't matter what you did. You always had to work harder. You always had to achieve more.
To be acknowledged and recognized, you need.
I don't know if it was to be acknowledged or recognized. I didn't really see it as acknowledgement. I saw it as it's another sort of mountain or thing to surpass and achieve.
But it wasn't acknowledgement. It's because people don't acknowledge you. They just keep telling you, move on. You've got more work to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. People are never satisfied with whatever you've done. And so that wishing someone would be satisfied once in a while could be part of this whole culture of overachievement that we seem to be stuck in.
Yeah. I actually didn't destroy that whole mantra of you got to work harder. I only destroyed it in the last 6 months.
And it's also a myth. If you work hard, nobody's going to notice.
Exactly. And if you're an achiever, you're achieving stuff. They don't actually know how hard you work to achieve any of those achievements.
Exactly.
Some of them might have been dead easy, and some of them might have been brutally hard. And to an extent, I don't even want the acknowledgement. You know, when people say, hey, well done on that, I'm like, well done for what? You know,
You
don't need to thank me for it.
Right.
So if anything, I'm being negative to my own achievements, which isn't great, because I think that can wear off on other people. And I think that there can be a lot of negativity around it in that, hey, here's someone who's achieving stuff and they're sort of downplaying it or poo-pooing it, as it were. And yet there's some other people who are struggling to achieve much. You know, so what are they thinking? How are they reacting, you know, if they're around me? That's not very good.
I'm just going to switch gears a little bit and ask you about the groups that influenced you as you were growing up, and then we'll move into the ones you chose to belong to. But I mean, we're born into a nation, we're born into a region, we're born into a social class. Like there's a geography that we're born into. People who are born on islands have a different sense of themselves than people who are born in the mainland or in the mountains and or close to the sea. All of those are parts of our culture and cultural norms that we are born into that we didn't have any choice for. And it can be also language, ethnicity, race. It can be religion. It can be education. All of those have to do with groups that we're born into. So of those and any others you can think of, what groups were you born into that you say continue to influence you now?
That's a great question. There's a question mark on how many of them still influence me now, but I guess they all do. I was not born in the UK. I was born in the Philippines. So I'm from Asian descent. And after I was born, we emigrated to the UK. So I was brought up in the UK and I went to a Catholic boarding school, highly religious because I came from the Philippines. And yeah, that's also Catholic. So that's religion being rammed down my throat, whether I liked it or not. So that is one thing. The second thing is, yeah, the school itself, as I said, it was a religious school. That was another thing. It was a boarding school. That was another thing. All boys school. That was another thing.
Yes.
And there were two things important in school, sport. And I wasn't great at that because I'm not a giant and I have terrible hand-eye coordination and academic prowess. Leaving school, I've always been influenced by where I worked. My friends or my social group was where I worked. Okay. Mm-hmm. Having been to a boarding school, you know, when school ended, people went, took off to wherever they came from on the planet. So, you know, friendships broke up as people flew to wherever they came from.
Mm. Did that feel disruptive to you?
I mean, you've been living with all these people literally for years, for your whole youth, and then they all disappear and, you know, they went off to university and I didn't. I ended up in the local supermarket. I threw myself into work or whatever. And so it was always around work and where I worked and the people I worked with that they influenced me. But in the early years of my career, as I was flip-flopping from job to job, there was another community. It was the accounting community. And then eventually, when I left the UK and started going overseas, it was an expatriate community wherever I went.
Yes. And maybe even if you're born in the Philippines, you go to the UK, and then you're in other countries, that sort of expat piece would be a part of who you are continuously, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is in the UK, since I'm not really from there, and back then, this is a long time ago, you know, this is going back into the 70s when I was at school, you know, there was you were picked on, you were bullied a bit for being a little bit foreign. And so I belonged, but I didn't belong. I wanted to belong, but I didn't belong. Funny enough, you know, when I came to Vietnam, okay, I stick out like a sore thumb here, but I felt more at home, as it were.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What caused you to feel more at home?
I think it's the people. Mm-hmm. The UK's changed, but, you know, back in the 70s, foreigners, not a good thing. You go to London today and people from every single country on the planet is there. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam, as a foreigner, my first residence permit is number 32. I mean, there weren't very many of us.
Yeah.
And you are a bit of a peculiarity, as it were. But that's okay. But the expat community, it was small. The country had only just opened up. You know, I was in the oil business. And so we knew each other. And it was a very, very, very tight community. Because there were only some dozens of us or hundreds of us, and very, very few people. So we really, really stuck together. And the folks from the oil patch, we really, really stuck together. It was a really, really, really nice group. And the thing being an expat, I suppose, is not all expats stay in the same place for a long time. They tend to move around. I was in the oil exploration business. So people usually got moved around every few years. My original posting was only for 1 year in Vietnam, and I ended up staying there for 4 years with that oil company. So people come and go all the time. However, the sort of community hangs together, even though people leave and join that community. But there's less of a sense of permanence, you know, connection with people, because people will move on and go to another country. But that just means your network goes very, very far and wide.
Yes.
It really does.
It's kind of like your boarding school experience, but in this case, you can stay in touch with people and you still have that network. So they disappear physically, but you can still connect and probably do find each other.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, you know, going into Vietnam in the early 90s, when there was literally nothing there, no real infrastructure as most people would want, everything is much a learning experience. Like, we're all in this together. So as a community, we're, you know, there's a lot of sharing. You know, we may be in competitor companies, but like, how do you do this? How do you do that? You know, where do you get this? Where do you get that? Mm-hmm. And we even talk about, hey, where do we get this food? You know, we're looking for this. Where can we buy it?
Right, right.
You know, it's a very, very close-knit group. There's a lot of giving and sharing. And to go back to your point is that, yeah, this really, really has influenced me. I mean, I've been in that environment for 3 decades.
Right.
For over half my life now. And so giving and sharing to me is just like, well, it's normal. If I know how to do something, if someone asks, I'll tell them how to do it. I'll share the knowledge. Like, what's the problem?
Exactly. There isn't a problem.
No, there isn't.
Did you feel you were able to create friendships among the Vietnamese?
A few. I've known some for a very, very long time. However, since I run a company there, and I've been running a company for 30 years, is it a friendship or is it because I'm the boss?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big cultural gap.
It is. There's a massive language gap. Okay, I'm terrible at languages apart from English. You know, 34 years in Vietnam, I still can't have a proper conversation. That's my choice.
Why would you choose that?
Why would I choose that? Well, fortunately, I'm a perfectionist. Languages has never been my strong suit. I'm here back in Switzerland now, in the German-speaking part of Switzerland. My wife is Swiss, but she speaks Swiss German, and no, we speak English. My Swiss German, like my Vietnamese, it sucks. So I say it's a choice because I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. Okay? Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm still telling myself, hey, I am not good at languages. Despite using Duolingo and doing my, I don't know how many days streak of trying to learn various languages like German and like Vietnamese, I'm still struggling.
Mm-hmm. We do set up these strange beliefs about what we can and can't do too. I have a friend who is really close to 100 years old at this point, and he spent many years of his life in China, and he was born in Canada, and he's lived in many other countries, and his wife is from India, and he kept saying he was terrible with languages, and he could never learn any other language, and that he failed at three, and so he gave up. When he went to China, he just took up Mandarin like a fish in water, and he's actually fluent in it, but all the other languages he couldn't do. He said, maybe it was that I just told myself no, and then in China, because I wanted to know the people, it changed. Or maybe it was just that language was the one that called to me. I don't know what it was, but I remember him talking to me about this on several occasions and saying, how did that happen that I felt like I was really pretty sure I was impossible at languages, and then all of a sudden Mandarin just seemed easy for me. I took Mandarin lessons for a year and I didn't find it easy. I mean, awe of any a Chinese person who's learned to speak English, because your mouth doesn't work the same way in either language. So you have to learn to reuse your mouth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you never know, right? But you may have hidden talents that you're not aware of.
Possibly, but I always believe it's a choice. I can use an excuse, I'm not good at languages. Mm-hmm. That could be used as a shield, like I don't want to try so hard, or I don't want to fail, which is probably what it really is.
Or I want to stick with what I know because I'm more comfortable there with that too.
Yeah, well, stick with what I know, which is anything that is non-lingual, not a foreign language, because I do like acquiring knowledge all the time. I do like learning every single day something. I'm a great fan of Kaizen, so it's my second core value.
Yeah.
But language doesn't rate high enough. There's always something else that I want to do first.
No, you have to have a hierarchy of what you're learning, otherwise you won't learn anything. So let me ask you about the cultures that you joined. So you said accounting felt like a culture, expats felt like a culture. Is there anything else that you felt you've developed a sense of belonging to a group as an adult?
There are a couple of networking or business groups or mastermind groups, however anybody wants to label them. So there's always been the accounting one of the accounting designations I have. I've always been actively promoting their brand in Vietnam. So that's always brought me close to that community. Whilst I was working in the oil patch, there was the oil community, which was definitely different. Of the business groups, there was a British business group, or there still is, in Vietnam. I helped found that, and I was on the board on and off for the last 20 odd years that it's been around. So that was another community, getting all the Brits together. There's another one with the Americans, and there's another one with the Europeans. You go to those business groups, you see the same people repeatedly, especially over the years. And you gradually get close together. There's a newer group that I've been part of for about 3 or 4 years. That's the Business Executive Network in Vietnam. I like that because it's basically all business execs, you know, company owners, C-level folks.
From around the world?
No, based in Vietnam.
I mean, are the C-level folks from around the world?
They're from all around the world. I'd say the majority of expats, you know, they could be working with the very, very large global multinationals, but also we have a lot of startups.
What about building capacity amongst the Vietnamese in Vietnam? Have you spent any time building capacity amongst the Vietnamese in Vietnam? Or is this just expats settling in Vietnam and then benefiting from it?
No, there's several things that my company does. We always believe in recruiting at the graduate level and train them up. It's typically taken us 3 to 5 years to train people up to what we want. And we've been doing it for 30 years and it hasn't got much faster. I think we can probably do it in 2 or 3 years, but we're investing many, many, many years into people. I'm big into internships. Mm-hmm. Okay. We've had, ever since we started internships, and we helped establish them in Vietnam, one of the universities, I think we've taken more than 1,000 interns. I'm doing a talk next week to an intern supplier, and I pulled out some stats for them. And I think we've had, in the last 6 years, we've taken, I think, nearly 600 interns. Mm-hmm. We've been at this for more than 20.
Yeah.
The other thing I do is, I've started again speaking at the universities, like when I'm back in Vietnam next week, speaking to the students there. Mm-hmm. I think there are about 150, 200 people turning up. I'll be doing a repeat topic that I've been doing around multiple universities, which is talk about personal growth in the digital age.
Right.
So I'm trying to teach them the importance of growing and how to grow in the face of all this digital distraction.
Mm-hmm. It's a good theme. Very pertinent.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it. They seem to like it as well.
I'm sure.
And the funny thing is there's not much digital in it.
No, that's not funny at all. That makes perfect sense to me.
It does. I don't think it does to them until they get it.
Well, we're moving forward in two main areas. One is digital and the other one is interpersonal skill development. You can't Absolutely. Have one without the other. You need them both if you want to be ready for the future of work. Mm. Let me ask you about temperament and personality. Temperament being what you're born with. And then nurtured through the social environment, of course, and then personality you add on once you either overcome or don't overcome some obstacle in your life, take advantage of or don't take advantage of some educational or job experience. So what would you say you're born with temperament-wise and that's still stuck with you? And what have you added on to your personality?
Good questions. I think I had traits of independence, but independence in the context of I can entertain myself. I'm happy in my own company. I can find stuff to do. So yeah, I've always been introverted. So I don't recharge by being around people. In fact, being around people drains me. Mm-hmm. I like my own time, pick up a book and read. I'm a real bookworm. So that's something I've always had. I don't know if it's a natural trait or, again, it's the environment and what's been schooled into me to study hard, to learn, to work hard, to really put your head down, to try and focus, cut out the distractions, and I guess be compliant. Again, being brought up in a boarding school, there are rules. It's a religious one. There are rules. There seem to be an awful lot of rules. But one of them is compliance. You're asked to do something, so you say, okay, I'll do it, and you do it. So again, I don't know if these are innate traits or something that's just been so heavily schooled into me, they've stuck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What have you added on?
I won't say I won't comply, but I have no difficulty challenging. Mm-hmm. I think it's all squashed out of us during our lives. Is I've resurrected the ability to challenge and to say why. And I am infinitely curious. And I've always been infinitely curious. And I've always want to know how things work. Mm-hmm. But in a work context, when I see things happening, I'm always trying to find out, like, why is it being done like that? Mm-hmm. Surely there must be a better way of doing it. So nothing is ever perfect. So I believe everything can always be made better. Mm-hmm. Not for the sake of you want to make it perfect. It's just if there's a process and by tweaking it, it can be made better. It's easier for the people doing it. They get a better result. It's less effort for them. We can take more of the grungy work and the more grunt work out of it. Why not? I'm a process person. I'm formulaic.
Right. Well, there's a formula, but then you analyze to see what's happening and then make adjustments, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, people around me or my family kid at me. They say, Rick, you've got OCD because I like everything in order. I says, I do not have OCD. Okay, because if it was done correctly, it would be CDO in the first place.
Yeah, and you need to have that kind of attention to detail when you're an accountant. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do your job.
Yeah, you could say that's for accounting. You can say that's for a technology, but it also applies to people.
Yes, for sure.
And I was never a people person, being the introvert. I'm uncomfortable around people, and I much prefer to be hide myself in a book or in numbers.
You're probably fine around people if you're in charge.
Sorry?
I'm sure you're fine around people if you're in charge.
These days, I'm fine around people if I'm not in charge.
But originally, now you've transformed. Mm-hmm. So you can be okay with being with people in a variety of circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, having that expat life, you know, people are coming and going, so your friends are coming and going as well, which means you have to keep on building relationships.
You do.
And we work in a lot of countries around the world. They're all same, same, but different. You know, you've got to find out the little nuances.
Yeah.
You know, around people, I think as I've got older, sometimes I don't want to lead. Mm-hmm. I'm quite happy being a follower. Because it can also be very tiring sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I have enough leadership decisions to make at work, out of work. I don't necessarily want to continue to make them. Hey, why can't I just go with the flow and
you don't want to be in charge of everything all the time is so exhausting. So let me ask you a couple more questions. Mm. Can you think of a time when your understanding that you thought was normal for everyone turned out to be cultural? So you have a moment of cognitive dissonance. You must have many because you've moved to so many different countries and had to adapt to different cultural contexts. So one that stood out for me was when I was 19, I went to France and I met my husband-to-be's relatives from an aristocratic family. They had maids and they ordered them around in a very disdainful way. And I was so shocked by that because I'd never experienced it before. I hadn't experienced anyone in extreme poverty or anyone who was really wealthy, and I hadn't experienced social class. It was a complete shock to me. I spent most of my time there just adjusting to try and find a balance in myself with what I was seeing around me. I had a similar experience when I went to Texas and there were people clamoring for a job for an hour or two and living in rags, and the people with extreme wealth would just step over them with their high heels and keep going with their lives. It was just such a shock to my system to see those extremes so close together like that. Those were two shocking moments for me. I'm writing about a time that you felt shocked from a cultural dissonance moment.
I'd say it would be early days in Vietnam when it was such an underdeveloped country to see people literally with nothing. And the fact that earning power and what they earned was so little, and yet they made ends meet and I'd say they were happy. I like Vietnam because the people are happy. And I just got the impression that they're positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come from the UK where, you know, we like to moan and complain about things.
Mm-hmm.
Moan about the weather. You know, we have mm-hmm. terrible weather in the UK. We moan about the weather. It's just a silly thing. Or people moan about the economy. If you go to Vietnam back in the early 90s, I said, these people have got literally nothing. Most of us were earning more in a day than they earned in months or a year.
Mm-hmm.
It was massive. And then the other cultural thing was, as we embrace the culture of an expat, and as an expat or a multinational, especially oil companies and some other industries as well, you know, you get paid well and you get looked after well. You get a good salary, you get a nice place to live, you might get a car, might get a driver, have some maids, have some guards. And so before you know it, you're living in an environment where you have people in your home there for you. They're there to cook, they're there to clean, they're there to do your ironing, you know, they're there to chauffeur you to and from work or wherever you want to go. And that becomes normal. And I guess the shock is that when you step out of that expat environment and fly back to Europe, to where I came from, and you sort of start mentioning these to people you know there, they look at you like some kind of alien.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that after only have been away for 2 or 3 years and living that life, how far away, not just geographically, but how much I had changed.
Mm-hmm. Those are great examples.
You know, you go back to the village where I was brought up, or, you know, I see some of my friends and hey, they're doing the same things, living in the same house, blah, blah, blah. And they sort of asked me, what have I done in the last few months? And I said, oh, I've been here, I've been there, I've been to this country, that country, I've done this, I've done that. It's just another world. Mm-hmm. And so over time, I stopped going back and speaking to these people because I felt embarrassed to talk about what life was like and what I had been doing.
Yeah. And they wouldn't understand it in any way that you could bridge the gap.
No, I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if they believe what I'm saying. And I find like, what is the point of saying this? Because I don't want them to say wow or anything. You know, it's hard to even have a conversation around it. Mm-hmm. And so I became the alien again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. That's really interesting and insightful. Now, you've written a book. Tell me a little bit about this book.
The book's called Business as Unusual, How mm-hmm. to Thrive in the New Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
It came out last year, and I really wrote it during the pandemic, you know, whilst we were locked down here. I mean, since we couldn't leave our homes, what else can we do apart write?
Bake bread and garden. Did you do that?
I was in an apartment, so no garden.
No gardening and no bread baking.
And no bread baking.
Yeah. So what's the book about?
The book is really about the fact that I found that during the pandemic and even after it, and even today, because things have been so disruptive, nothing is going back to normal. Maybe some people are still searching to go back to business as usual, go back to normal the way it was, but that isn't happening, which is an issue because if they don't like where they are now or what they're doing, and they're not too sure where to go, I won't say they're lost, but they're not really going anywhere.
What would I learn if I read your book?
To discover how to organize what I call your castle and set yourself up for long-lasting success. Because the metaphor that I've created in the book is a castle, and the castle is a metaphor for your life journey. And every building has a purpose. And since it's your castle, you can architect it any way that you want. All you have to decide is, how do you want to build these buildings? What do you want to focus on in your life? And so what I give are a whole load of tools for different aspects of your life to help you develop your mindset, to help you how to develop habits, how to align your internal purpose with your external goals, you know, how to build your inner self and strengthen that, and then how to expand your outer self. And I put a whole load of assessments and tools and exercises in there, more than anyone would need, because you can pick and choose. So on any one thing, I might give five different ways of doing it. Find the one that you like. Find the one that resonates with you.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it would be a useful book to go back to over time.
I think so.
So is there anything else you'd like to tell me about that we haven't had a chance to bring up or discuss?
No, not really. I think we've covered everything. You know, to everyone listening, we just need to remember that we're not participants in this ever-changing world, but we're really architects, and we're shaping the course of our own lives, our own careers, and the world around us. And I encourage people to embrace change and try and define it rather than just adapt to it. You know, be that catalyst in a business as unusual world. I'm not going to guarantee that it works, but like all tools and all frameworks, you've got to try them first. Maybe it will help.
And there can be something useful in it. There can be useful in that framework for everybody, no matter what their circumstances are, even if the whole framework isn't useful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree with that.
Well, thank you so much for spending this time with the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners and with me. I really appreciate your willingness to answer all these questions and to reflect on what you've been doing. And it sounds like you've had a very interesting life. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you, Marie. Really, thank you, thank you, thank you. I'd like to express my gratitude to you for allowing me on your podcast today. It's been a really fascinating conversation. And I hope your listeners have enjoyed it as much as I have.
Oh,
and
good.
To all you listeners out there, I really, really appreciate your time and attention. And more importantly, I look forward to hearing from some of you, learning from your experiences, the cultures that you come from, and perhaps sharing more in-depth future discussions. Mm-hmm. Thanks again, Marie.
Oh, you're most welcome. And all of your contact information that you provided will be in the show notes so people can get in touch with you and give you some feedback. And thank you again. Have a wonderful rest of the day.
You too.
Rick Ivanovich has traveled the globe, making significant business inroads in Vietnam and the UK in multiple industries. I admire his willingness to take on new challenges and adventures while building them into profitable ventures for himself and many, many other people. His business acumen and excellence offered him the opportunity to build a life for which he truly was the architect. We can all learn from his ability to take charge and look for ways to get through and overcome difficulties. I enjoyed my interview with Rick and was particularly tickled that he sent such a kind note saying how much he enjoyed our interview together as well. If you know a business person who would learn a thing or two from an expert like Rick Ivanovich, send them to his website or send them to connect with him on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and may culture and leadership connections continue to inspire and guide your day. Listeners can now interact with Culture and Leadership Connections podcast by leaving a voice or text message on Fan List. It is a fun and quick way to let me know what you liked, ask a question, or leave a suggestion. I will feature some of the voice messages on upcoming episodes. You might be surprised to hear your own voice, but only if you leave a message, of course. So to leave your personal message or your question, go to shiftworkplace.com/podcast and click on the Fan List link to leave it. I can hardly wait to hear what you have to say.